Good afternoon, everyone. On this last afternoon of our last full day of Sesshin, who knows what number it is. Sometimes numbers are really useful and sometimes they just really flummox us. I'd like to start off with just a little quote from Dogen's Unbroken Practice. This life of one day is a life to rejoice in. Because of this, even though you live for just one day, if you can be awakened to the truth, that one day is vastly superior to an eternal life. If this one day in the lifetime of 100 years is lost, will you ever get your hands on it again? So that just reminds us to be mindful, alert, awake, and not drift and lose our life. So that brings me to the talk today is on do not neglect mindfulness. So when we neglect mindfulness, we get caught up in the projections of the mind, one way or another, and led around. But we're lucky because we are Dharma practitioners, so we have tools, and we are Dharma practitioners, and we are EIs. We're existential investigators, all of us. And not neglecting mindfulness is a primary tool. It lets us know when we're on a case. When we pick up clues. So as we move through this last full day of Sesshin, it seems appropriate to dwell now a bit on mindfulness. And it's a word we hear constantly. We use it all the time, and it can become a non, just a throwaway. So it's good to take a look at what the Buddha meant by mindfulness, and what the potential is for mindfulness, and where it fits in with our practice. Mindfulness and meditation—they're not the same thing. So that's what I'm going to look at now. So very often at this time of Sesshin, we are admonished not to jump ahead, and we say that these are the last hours, which are so vital and important to stay with practice. And this is true. It's important not to jump back into the whirl and the whirl of our mental projections, the whirl of our life. I always say when I get home from a Sesshin, now I have to spend a day remembering my life. Not to do it precipitously. And drop practice altogether, which is sometimes what happens. We have whatever kind of Sesshin we have, and then we go home and we just forget it. We forget all about it. And so it's important to think about, all right, so how do we integrate whatever wisdom has come out of Sesshin or has kind of become clearer with my usual round in a world that's in no way reflects this particular setup and these attitudes and these ways of aspiration. So when we just jettison mindfulness, meditation, it all, we're forfeiting hours of our life. We're forfeiting portions of our life. And one of the things that's important to tune into in the time of transition, and of course every moment is a transition, but this is a particular one, is that no matter what kind of Sesshin you've experienced or how you'll label it, it releases tremendous amount of mental energy. And so unless we maintain practice and mindfulness, all of that energy just can fly up into the mental apparatus, and we can just be a whirl, a swirl in thoughts and kind of a frenzy of thinking and talking. So it's good to be attuned to gentling ourselves into our usual daily round and keeping ourselves grounded. So today we continue with our practice with as much diligence as we can muster and enjoy the serenity of these hours of sesshin and this container of sesshin, these ideal circumstances to support serenity and clarity and openness, edgeless awareness, not getting caught up in content particularly, savoring this time, these moments. But it is inevitable that we begin to recall our regular lives and to prepare. The Buddha knew 3 months before his death that it was coming up. And he spent that time in preparation. And it is important to make room for preparation and transition. So during that time, he meditated a great deal, and in his last hours, he entered into many ever-deepening states of concentration, and then would emerge as part of his preparatory final emergence into parinirvana. But he was mindful of the distress. He was noticing the distress that a number of his disciples had at his passing. And he emerged again and then invited his students to ask any last questions that he could clear up for them before before he dropped the body. And then he responded with kindness and clarity, pretty much with the teachings that he had been offering his whole life. And these eight realizations are part of those final offerings. So at this time in sesshin, it's really natural for the mind to begin to stir and to remember our involvements in our regular lives, the business end of things, and to bring back all the things we're worried about or uncertain about, decisions that have to be made, bills that have to be paid, the whole catastrophe, and which we call samsara, huh? All of the conditions of a human life. And as we emerge, we want to tune into whatever wisdom we have gained in this sesshin through not neglecting mindfulness. Not neglecting mindfulness. Mindfulness is how the word in Pali, sati, was translated, mindfulness. And it has, one of the aspects of its meaning is remembering. So the recollection of quiet mind. Part of mindfulness is remembering quiet mind, not losing track and getting so caught up in our projections that we forget that these are projections, which is ballast. You know, quiet mind is really ballast, so we don't fly off into all the many hell realms and all of the realms of reactivity that we can find ourselves in. And with mindfulness, we can also remember to return to regular meditation. which is not something that we do. We don't demand of our daily life that we are in a meditative state. That wouldn't work on a practical level, but also it's not what's going on. But to be able to make sure that we carve out time for regular meditation, to return to the spaciousness and the open, edgeless field of being, of mind. And to recall, as Jogen pointed out, impermanence. That's kind of the base of mindfulness. When we are mindful, we are always taking a look at what's unfolding now, and now, and now, and never the same. So we've been living the Sesshin moments and Sesshin life flowing along in a matrix of now. Now is not just this, because as soon as the is out, the is gone, right? There's no graspable moment. It's a flow. Flowing along in various patterns through this week of light and dark, mind chatter, whispers of thought, and moments of silence. Quiet, activity, ease, difficulty, expanding, contracting, tensing, relaxing, dreaming, waking. So many mind states and qualities of energy have filled the flow, have emerged from flow. You may remember earlier in Sesshin what it was like. There's a poem by Jim Harrison, very short, which I think really captures the early moments of Sesshin. Some nights are three nights long. Some days a mere noon hour, then whistled, back to work, the heart dredging sludge. Oh, that's where we touch down in Sesshin, huh? But by now, this last full day, it is more likely like this. This is a short poem by Ted Kooser. Each clock tick falls like a raindrop right through the floor as if it were nothing. Here we sit in the quiet of the afternoon. We may be in touch with the possibility of truly being in each moment as it springs forth in awareness, without any fixity, without any fixed unchangingness to be found moment by moment in our flow of awareness. Yet the mind we ordinarily experience with, the me mind, the elaborating mind, thinking, 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 roof brain chatter, as Aitken Roshi calls it, roof brain chatter, confines us to a life where we're small talking things. That's a phrase that Louise Gluck uses, small talking things. I just love the simplicity of it. It really gets it. Yak, 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 yak. Small talking things. Small talking thing, me, is not aware of the nature of my thoughts. When I am the small talking thing, I am not aware. I'm wrapped up in them. They lead me around. And they seem quite real. They're quite fixed and immutable. That's the impression I'm under, right? So take, for instance, the example of how we label our practice. You know, this was a good sit. This was a terrible sit. practice is going well. It's really crummy. I can't do this. Most of us get caught up in these various states of mind. We have these experiences. And what we mean by good practice is experiencing some special state. But whatever is more usually going on is all the ordinary mental gyrations that we do. And we label this bad practice. Or we might even say it's Dharma trash. You know, I noticed that in one of the bathrooms here, there's a can that's labeled trash. That's what brought this whole thought to mind, is we call this, you know, when we're sitting there and our minds are yakking away, this is Dharma trash and it's unworthy. It's unworthy of anything. It's very devalued. But actually, that's not so. It's not trash. Because when we continue with diligent practice, as diligent as we can manage it, and that varies. Sometimes you can feel like you're being very diligent, and other times it's just a wish, but you're nowhere near being able to maintain any sense of diligence. But when we do, then we can attend to the trash. We can take out the trash, so to speak, and have a look. Ardent and mindfully aware. So the first thing we have to do is notice. Notice thoughts and notice our attitude toward thought. Oh, this is a trash thought. This is one that I just would rather throw out. And we become, we don't pay attention to it. But when we do, and we are quite meticulous in what makes up this thought, and who is thinking it, and where does it come from, not as an intellectual exercise, but direct looking, we become intimate with what it is that we thought we most ardently wanted to reject and to push out of our awareness. And we come to realize that it's the pushing away rather than the content and feeling that makes up our discontent about that. And that can lead us to insight into just how we have been maintaining our suffering. This, yes. That, no. Picking and choosing what parts of our experience are worthy and what are not worthy. Leaving us with a sense of when we look at it and we begin to see what makes it up and our response to it, this leaves us with a sense of possibility and a choice. But if we hold back and don't acknowledge our experience in the first place, if we're not mindful, or our judgmental mind is so in charge that we just will not make room, then we can't look more closely at what is occurring. We can't look more closely at what we're feeling, what we think, attitudes, any aspect of our experience. And we can develop a serious case of spiritual bypass, which is thinking that our practice is all about rising above everything, that we don't have to deal with our confusions and our anger and all the things that really hurt. Getting curious about the process of mental trash making, we discover how to practice with everything in our life. Everything. Nothing is excluded. And mindfulness is the key here. Sensations, feelings, moods, seeing it all as ephemera. Recognizing that it is baseless, it spontaneously flashes forth. And you might say, well, wait a minute, it doesn't spontaneously flash forth. It has to do with, well, you know, 7 years ago, blah, 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 and when I was a child, da, da, da. That's the story aspect. And to recognize we know our stories, And they have guided our choices. That's being guided by samsara rather than vow. But our life is what it has been, and our feelings and all of our responses currently come forth conditioned by all of those past factors. So we don't just throw them out without really being intimate with what that's all about and how that's working. And how it contributes to our sense of fixity, having a fixed, permanent self. How it undermines our ability to really see through to the very open and spacious nature of our life and this sense of self and investigate self directly. Because what makes up the sense of self? Our feelings, our sensations, our thoughts, right? Everything that we come up with is what comprises our sense of me and mine. So mindfulness, moment by moment presence, helps us notice what's going on. We are present and in relation to and remembering to be present moment by moment. So whatever appears initially, when we come closer and become intimate, precise in our looking, non-reactive, everything comes forth as our true path. And a lot of the time we see, most of the time we see that things are not what they seem. So here's a short poem. A crumpled candy wrapper is just another flower in the rain. Or conversely, that flower in the rain is just another crumpled candy wrapper. The way that our senses project onto things is so often it's playful. It's playful and it's not inherent. And it's not permanent, it's not fixed. So in Sesshin, we slow down to stop. We don't get too caught up in special mind states, whether we want to or not. We may want to. what more likely happens is special mind state one moment, ordinary mind states the next. We can say this another way, that mind states that we haven't encountered before and feel pleasant kind of ooze over into mind states that we're really familiar with and we don't particularly like. And our miseries we get back into the clutches of our miseries, these fixed habitual traps. But actually, the clutches of our fixed traps, steel traps, are actually our own clutches. And they are to be found in our habitual mind, our habitual feelings, our habitual moods, our habitual thoughts. All of this we're so identified with. Not neglecting mindfulness. As we approach the transition to our workaday routines and places in space where we usually live, it's particularly important to bring forth not neglecting mindfulness, to practice mindfulness, to practice self-compassion, wholehearted presence, no matter where we are or with whom we are. So we've all been going through this together, and we've silently moved harmoniously through many, many, many hours together. When we step out of here, no one has been in Sesshin. No one even knows what that is. And so to maintain mindfulness in those settings is very challenging. And there are certain things that can be very useful. So mindfulness registers everything. It registers all the changing world continually, and also what doesn't change. In meditation, we encounter what is unchanging, potentially. What doesn't get born, what doesn't die. That which occurs outside of time, of the matrix of time. Just this, just for now. Close to death, you begin to see what's under your nose. You begin to see what you're hearing, seeing, sensing. And because you're potentially, you're able to, you are so focused, the body is so focused, the mind is so focused on impermanence, on the moment-by-moment changes that are going on that cannot be ignored, that your attention is drawn in a very focused way. You can react in all kinds of ways, as Jogen laid out in his talk. But this focus, I want to read again that Emily Dickinson poem. I heard a fly buzz when I died. The stillness in the room was like the stillness in the air between the heaves of storm. I willed my keepsakes, signed away what portion of me be assignable. And then it was, there interposed a fly with blue, uncertain, stumbling buzz between the light and me. And then the windows failed. And then I could not see to see. Now that's really an intimate moment. That's intimate. We all have these moments. We might pass by them, not notice them. Not neglecting mindfulness. So one of the characteristics that the Buddha lays out is not getting distracted by sense desire. And the way that I read that is, not that sense desire does not arise, but that we are mindful and we are aware of it that it is sense desire. Maintaining attention with the whole body and mind. It's not just maintaining attention with the mind. It's maintaining attention with the whole body. If we're maintaining attention just with the mind, we may actually not notice all kinds of information that we get intuitively, that comes direct, that comes through our senses, that comes through what we see, what we hear, what we smell, people's auras, just the energy. And then when we're mindful, we're taking a look at what's currently happening for the time being, free from elaboration, free from commentary, not looking somewhere else, but right here. And what comes to mind here again is addiction. Because when we're addicted to whatever it is that we're addicted to, we could say we're addicted to thought. Well, I don't know, we're habituated to thought. We're in the clutches of thought. But when you're an addict, you're fixated on the drug. You're fixated on, and everything in your life is dedicated to getting it, having it, taking it, feeling it. So everything is wrapped up there, and you're really not free to smell the roses or to avail yourself of any of the moments of clarity, intimacy, delight that has nothing to do with drug and the drug state and the special mind state. So mindful, sincere, unstinting wholeheartedness, committed, simple, because we're not elaborating. We're in full relationship to what's right here, just this. Never somewhere else, never something else, just this. Sid Corman, who's an old-time Zen meditator, comments, for all the abundant air, you can only breathe one breath at a time, and you can't save it up. That came out of breath meditation. That has profound implications for our life. It's a very simple thing to notice, but so the characteristics of mindfulness, they're always it's always in the present moment. It's not somewhere else or something else. Always in the present moment. Non-judgmental. Non-reactive. If we are noticing something and our inner critic gets caught up, then we're not open, we're not really able to be mindful. And mindfulness excludes nothing. We can be mindful from the very kind of gross physical impressions and experiences to extremely, extremely subtle shifts in our inner mind stream. So it is moment by moment available. And the Buddha says that mindfulness can also say that it's maintaining right thought. And what do I mean by right thought? Not getting distracted by sense desire. Maintaining presence, staying in full relationship, not cutting off being in relation, which is another characteristic of addiction. Addiction is, instead of relationship to everything as it is, we're in relationship to only one thing, which is avoiding everything. The Buddha says that mindfulness is putting away greed and distress in reference to the world and abiding ardent and aware. So now we're going out into our workaday world where there's a lot of lot going on. And so we have a good lab for noticing how we get caught up in the incredible stuff that's happening in this world that's very, very distressing. And how it keeps us from being able to be thoroughly present because we are drawn off by our own distress. Dogen says, when your mindfulness is solid, you will not be harmed even if you go into the midst of the robbers of the five senses, of the five sense desires. It is like wearing armor and going into a battlefield. So there's nothing to be afraid of. It's called not neglecting mindfulness. Going back into the world of family, work, neighborhood, world affairs, nothing to be afraid of with mindfulness. That's something to ponder. How, in what sense is that, does that work in your own experience? That's why I think it's so important to look into what mindfulness refers to. It's not just paying attention. It's paying attention all the way down to the very source. It's part of the refuge, not just being caught up in appearances and in the conventional mind states of the world, but also bringing to it the spaciousness that is not contingent on conditions. So we pay close attention to the details of what's going on internally and externally. We don't flinch or run away. We trust what happens. And how do we work with whatever comes up? Well, there's one extremely potent teaching, which is called the Four Foundations of Mindfulness. And we can use them to help us out in any situation when we get caught. The first is mindfulness of the body in the body. So looking at, in any state of mind and distress, looking at what's happening in the body, where are we registering this quality of difficulty and distress, restlessness, hatred, anger, whatever it is. Where in the body, how does the body carry that? The second is mindfulness of feelings, meaning that second arrow of pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. And that in itself is a very wonderful daily practice, to notice each moment when you tune into it and you recall it through mindfulness, to ask yourself in each situation, what is the valence here, the emotional valence? Do I like this? Do I not like this? And how it colors, that's very often out of our awareness, but it colors how we respond to most things, whether something is unpleasant, pleasant, or neutral. It's hard to find neutral, but occasionally. The third is mindfulness of mind as mind, and I think of that as the weather front, or the energetic quality of our experience. So it can be calm, it can be excited, it can be fixed, it can be spacious, you know, just that general weather front, general mood. It can be, you know, very pushed down or very lifting up, uplifted. And then the last one is mindfulness of mind, mental formations. So that's anything, any form, which is everything, any form, being aware of it. So being aware of thought, being aware of sensation, being aware of fantasy, being aware of just what is it that's inhabiting the mind stream. And those really give us a way to work with anything that comes up within our own self when we're struggling, because it gives us some room and it puts us back in touch with the mind that is not involved with that clump of experience, the larger field of awareness. Because where does mindfulness come from but from awareness? Huh? We bring awareness up. We carry the intention for awareness. Paying close attention to the details of what's going on internally and externally, and what keeps us from being able to be present. Whatever it is that keeps us from being able to be present is Mara. You know the story of Mara, one of them, one of the many. Mara is found often in the, or on some regular basis in the Pali Canon. And the night that the Buddha sat down and resolved not to get up until he was enlightened, the story goes that he's sitting there, He's really settled himself through all of the states of more and more and more precise, concentrated awareness. And then Mara comes along. Oh, you think that you're concentrated, do you? So she sends along an army, a fierce army that rushes straight at him. And the Buddha maintains the seat of Zazen. He's not thrown off. He maintains his concentration. All right, so Mara thinks that didn't work. I'll send in a beautiful seductress who dances or whatever. And, you know, these fantasies in the mind, sexual fantasies that come up for a lot of people, especially in Sesshin, but anyway, in life. And they can really bring about big problems. But anyway, the Buddha sits there and he's stable. His concentration is stable. And that's one of the things we've been cultivating, is stability in our meditation. So then she sets up a beautiful, delicious meal with lovely aromas. And that too doesn't throw him off. And at the end of the night, he awakens and then he says, Mara, now I know you. Now I know you. And we can all take a look at all the things that throw us off our resolve to stay with this broad, open, spacious mind. So that's pain, you know, physical stuff that comes up, Mara. Memories that come back to us that are very disturbing, Mara. Because none of that's happening right now, right? Plans, terrific imaginative inspirations, all kinds of stuff comes up. You know what I'm talking about. And we can regard that as Mara. And we can say, I know the nature of you. And I will stay put. The inner critic. We really fall. I mean, a lot of people are very, very caught by Mara, an inner critic. That's another way to look at it, huh? The sense of not being okay, no matter what you do or who you be, or not knowing who you be. So paying close attention to what's going on. Trusting the method. How diligent is your gaze in meditation? How mindful are you through the day? Can you really keep track and be present? Basho says it this way: touring the world, tilling a small field to its limits. Find the limits, find the edges if you can. So whatever is going on in your small field is your limitless life. And when we allow for that and notice the edges of our awareness and see, are there really edges? Then this life is limited and limitless. So with meditation and with mindfulness, we develop a way to be steady enough to encompass all of it. Do not neglect mindfulness, but returning to the source. One of the things about being present is it's filled with delights. You know, walking back from, maybe it was breakfast this morning or one of the meals, the little top knot of the bowls, walking along creating a bit of a stir of air, it filled the sails of the top knot and it stood straight up like a proud little sail. I take my pleasures where they come. But that's what's available. You know, when you can really be present, there's all kinds of, the universe is very playful. There's a lot of play to be noticed. To study the Buddha way is to study the self. To study the self is to forget the self, and to forget the self is to be enlightened by the 10,000 things. Anything and everything is the 10,000 things, the numberless aspects of our life. When we don't neglect mindfulness, we allow the 10,000 things to fill our life. And it's amazing how they continuously assemble and reassemble in very playful ways. What happens to me, what my thoughts are, how I feel, what I say, all of it makes up this ordinary miracle that is, we can be present to in at any moment. Here's a little three-liner by Greg Abels. Subway ride, time to stare at my hands. Now there's a man who meditates, huh? That can be complete, a moment like that. Complete. Not neglecting mindfulness is rather like allowing each ordinary thing its sacred life. Giving life to the 10,000 things. Or another way to say it is mindfulness, the poetics of the moment. You know, what are the poetics of the moment? As a person who really enjoys poetry and feels really tutored by poetry, and it's the infinite way that it relates to conventional language. I like to sometimes, rather than practice mindfulness, I practice the poetics of this, right here and now. Wide open, playful, unexpected. Here's another one by Greg Abel. Seeing the twilight moon, I don't go on. Sometimes we do just get stopped in our tracks. Green mountains have turned yellow so many times. The troubles and worries of the world of things no longer bother me. One grain of dust in the eye will render the three worlds too small to see. When the mind is still, the floor where I sit is endless space. Just this now, endless space, no actual edges. This poem really expresses a momentary realization. And mindfulness is always momentary. It's always momentary. Just this. Directly, minutely, in the specifics and the uniqueness of this. Just this. Whatever it is. The poetics of the moment. And the mind is still. The trance of permanence, the fixated mind is dispelled like magic. And there's a clarity and a luminosity to just being, just this. So, back into our ordinary lives. Family, work. Do not neglect mindfulness. Don't just shuck off the experience of Sesshin, but let it echo as a a liveliness of mindfulness. Huh? Let that always coming back be part of how you go about your daily round. Using the four foundations of mindfulness to deal with whatever comes up, to open it up, to bring in the spaciousness of a situation that may seem very small and very fixed and absolute. It isn't. To bring in spaciousness when we are in a reactive state. So the third foundation of mindfulness is that general kind of weather front energetic pattern. And when we're in a state of reactivity, it's very held together. So bringing in some spaciousness, remembering, that's the mindfulness, remembering to do that. And that also, the whole sense of separate self is a very fixed situation. And so when we come into conflict with somebody, you know, when we're all working side by side in silence and we have a strict schedule and everybody knows what they're supposed to do when and bells tell us and we don't have a lot of conflicts with each other. But, you know, moments after leaving here, who knows what's going to happen? And contemplate, you know, how the sense of fixed, separate self is operating in conflict is really useful. And how the sense of I, me, and mine, it's opinion, again, I have an opinion or I have a need, and it is central, and I will defend it, and I will put it forward no matter what. And so that's really narrowly defining the self. When we open up the self to include the well-being of everyone involved, then it goes in a very, very different way. We're part of a lineage going all the way back to the Buddha and even before that urges us to look into the great matter of life and death. We have the blessings of an ancient lineage helping us, all of whom were themselves formed in an edgeless, spacious mind of their own times and places. I mean, it's kind of amazing that this meditation inclination has been part of us for thousands and thousands of years, thousands of years. And at the time that that our ancestors were meditating, that was now, then. We inherit this gift of a path to awakening from them and awaken to the very same open, spacious ground of being. Awaken to the source of our own mind-created elaborations. So this practice of never neglecting mindfulness turns us back again and again and again to how we take direct responsibility for our own awakening. Muso Kokushi says, to reach the fundamental ground is not something like going from the country to the city or from one land to another. In reality, it's like waking up from a dream. All the questions about where the fundamental ground is and how to get there are part of the dream, arising from the thoughts of a dream about a dream. So anything we say about, or we look for over there, or in some formulation, is not to the point. What's to the point is our direct experience. Mindfulness is saying to us, right here, right now, what? Awakening each moment, fully and completely, to just this. So, keep coming back, paying attention. Don't let it flag as we go through these final hours. And more importantly, don't think that this is the real practice and out there isn't. It's just different. And it's, I always think of regular daily life as the real sesshin, the place that takes real diligent practice and mindfulness. And getting to it when I sit down on the cushion, taking myself in hand, putting the thinking, being aware of thinking, and saying, not now. Kind of like the Mara thing. Mara, not now. Doesn't always work, but sometimes it does. And that's the point of not neglecting mindfulness, is staying right here, right now. This is it. This is our life. Don't miss it.